Hello and welcome to Lodcast. This episode we speak with Ron Friedman, Chief Knowledge and Information Officer at LAC Group, industry commentator, author and collaborator with LOD. We talk about the successes, the failures and the future of technology in the legal space. We also cover the meteoric rise of legal operations, whether it's here to stay, change management, real examples of ROI on legal investment and much, much more. Hi, Ron. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you give our listeners a bit of a background about who you are, what you do, what you've done, those kind of things?
Sure. So my name is Ron Friedman. I'm currently the Chief Knowledge and Information Officer for LAC Group. LAC Group, among other services, provides outsourced research and library services. And I've been in the legal market for three decades inside of two large law firms, two legal software companies, and two consulting companies, and then to outsourcing companies. So I've seen the legal market from multiple angles.
Great. And one of the things we wanted to talk about on today's episode is legal tech and kind of what that means. Firstly, legal and sometimes referred to as law tech, how would you plot that on a hype curve?
Well, I assume you mean the Gartner hype curve. And if we do, then I don't think we've reached the peak of inflated expectations yet. So for people who are not familiar, there you start and you go up a curve, you get to the peak of expectations, and then you have a sudden fall to the valley of what they call the valley of despair. And when you realize that it's not all that it was cracked up to be, and I think we're still climbing that curve, but I think we're nearing the peak. And happy to expand a little further if that's helpful and why.
Yeah, I think that would be good. One thing I'll do is I'll put a link to the kind of Gartner hype curve in the show notes so people can visualize it for themselves. But I want to spend a bit more time on it. Firstly, legal versus law tech, same thing or different?
I don't draw that distinction. I do read articles where I see people drawing the distinction between legal and law tech. And I have to say, even though I'm deep into it, I have found that distinction somewhat baffling. So we go back to the hype curve. I think the market overall is nearing its peak. And the reason I say that is we could argue about how the current hype over innovation relates to what I consider the prior hype over legal artificial intelligence. And we had a period of 2 or 3 years of legal AI hype before everyone realized that it was overblown. And I'm not sure we ever had a crash, but people developed more realistic expectations. And I think we're getting there for legal tech. But it also, it's potentially not so helpful to lump all legal tech together. And you can look at specific legal technologies and say some of them are meeting, I think, general expectations and others are not. And so it's probably more helpful to think about it technology by technology.
Thanks for that, Ron. So what do you think makes the legal industry unique vis-a-vis the challenges of innovation?
Well, many people argue it's unique, and I'm not sure I agree. And this could be a difficult conversation because what is the metric of difficult? I think that there are adoption challenges across the board and that we also need to distinguish between law departments and law firms. And law departments are cost centers and they're often underfunded and under-resourced. And they have more challenges than law firms, which are profit centers. I think the challenge across those two organizations and for all lawyers is they are known to be precedent-oriented and it's harder for them to change. But in order to get to that change, you need a very compelling answer to the with me question, the what's in it for me? And we don't always get that so readily the way we do for the big changes we've seen in the consumer market like Starbucks, Uber, or Amazon.
And how much do you think let's take the law firm for a second, how much do you think the billable model affects the ability to innovate?
Well, I think it's a huge barrier because there's not much economic incentive if you look only at billable hours to find more efficient ways of working. And I hope when people talk about innovation, they attach that to benefits. And the benefits, in my view, need to be either increased productivity, by which I mean more output per hour and based on efficiency, or better outcomes. Otherwise, why bother innovating? And the efficiency piece is hampered by the billable hour. On one hand, on the other hand, even in some large and very profitable law firms where I've done consulting or had discussions with friends or other business, I hear from partners regularly, even in top firms, they face budgets and there is pressure to be efficient. So yes, it's a barrier, but I don't think it's insurmountable.
And some of our listeners operate in the legal departments, as you mentioned. What's the real, what do you think the biggest challenge in legal departments is for innovation?
Well, I think that depends on the law department, but when I attended CLOT last year, and I talked to a couple of in-house legal ops people, and they said their corporate IT, and these are very large law departments and huge corporations, and their corporate IT departments would only let them use what the rest of the corporation used. That can be pretty limiting. So some it's a corporate IT, others just don't have very big budget for anything other than paying outside counsel and paying their lawyer's salary. So they're relative to law firms, for the most part, I believe they are under-resourced, with some exceptions.
Ron, in your In Collaboration report with LED, Cutting Through the IT, which I'll add a link in the show notes, you create a 7-step approach to problem solving. I'm just wondering, can you tell our listeners how you came up with that 7-step approach?
First, I'm going to give the qualifier, which is I'm not someone who likes clickbait headlines and clickbait subheadings. And I was aware that there's a lot of the 10 steps to X or the 5 steps to Y. But as I thought about the problems that lawyers, wherever they work, have to solve, I wanted to give some practical guidance. And I just thought somewhat long and hard about, in my experience, what were those problems? And that's really how I came up with it. And I didn't go into it saying it must be 7, but I was able to say what I wanted to say in seven bullets. So it's not that sexy an answer, unfortunately.
Okay, that's no problem. The next question we wanted to talk about today is around the echo chamber. And I think that's something which is quite apparent to people who exist certainly in the legal tech sector, but also the general legal innovation space. What tips do you have to people to avoid those echo chamber effects of living within that legal innovation community?
Sorry, what was that? I think that I heard an echo. Just kidding. It's a real challenge. And I think some people don't avoid it. So I was born and raised in the borough of Queens in New York City, which makes me a skeptical New Yorker. And I went to law school, so that increases the skepticism. So I've always been able to maintain some distance. But I think the challenge is when you go to conferences that are about legal tech or about innovation, they're like rallies more than sober discussions. And so there's just a huge amount of hype and confirmation bias because you're talking to everyone who is a believer, and the non-believers and the non-adopters are not attending. So that's the problem. The solution to overcome the echo chamber is to stay somewhat dispassionate and stay very close to the customer. So if you're in-house counsel, stay close to your in-house clients. If you're law firms, stay close to your clients, whether they're business people or other lawyers, because that's who you need to serve. That's where the proverbial rubber meets the road, and you need to run the ideas by your clients and customers to understand if they will work or not. And I think too many people in the innovation bubble are not doing that.
So, Rob, this might be a tricky question, but what's the best example that you've personally seen of legal innovation?
Well, that's a hard one to answer, right? Because it goes back to what I said earlier, that we don't really have good metrics. But if I look at where there's been wide adoption and powerful anecdotal data, I'll give two that may not stand out for everyone else. But the first is predictive coding in electronic discovery. I know it still remains controversial, but by using computerized techniques to review documents in contentious matters, at least under U.S. law, it applies less in other jurisdictions, lawyers have really been able to increase their output. That is the number of documents they review per hour because the machine is doing more for them. And that started happening 15 plus years ago. The other example where I think that's very good is machine learning products for contract review, whether it's due diligence in a transaction or for a corporation deploying contract lifecycle management, being able to extract clauses from contracts automatically with a reasonably high degree of accuracy speeds up the process noticeably. Now, has anyone, there have been some measures over time. I don't think there's been a sort of a total industry measure, but those are the two that stand out.
And I guess an interesting question for our listeners, maybe the flip side of that coin, is there a particular disappointment that you have around a piece of legal innovation that you thought was going to succeed wildly and ended up floundering a little bit?
Yeah, I got involved as a consultant in the early aughts, I think around 2003. One of the first projects I did was on contract lifecycle management for in-house counsel. And it was still relatively new as a product category then. And I thought, surely this will solve a lot of problems, because I had talked to clients when I was at law firms about the challenges of managing contracts. And it just seemed like an obvious solution for a lot of the problems I had heard about. And uptake still remains limited because it requires, it's a change management challenge that you have to, for good uptake, you need many parts of an organization to work in unison, and they don't always have the motivation to do that. So I think that's a noticeable disappointment.
And to quickly kind of change tack away from the technology piece and to look at more people and process, there's a lot of discussion for the past few years around legal operations, and we've seen the rise of organizations like Clock, which are growing year on year. And if you look on Twitter or LinkedIn, you'll see a lot of talk about legal ops. I was wondering what your opinion on legal operations is. Do you think it's here to stay for a while?
Absolutely, but I don't know if its growth will be as meteoric as it has been over the last, say, decade. Just the fact that you're asking, is it here to stay? I will counter and say, I'm not sure why anyone would think it's going to go away, which is different than saying, will it continue its rapid growth? The reason it's here to stay is all organizations need a management layer. And before legal operations, at least in my opinion, it was pretty clear to me that large law departments were undermanaged. They really didn't have professional managers, and the GC and assistant or associate GCs were often spending most of their time practicing law. So it was like a law firm where partners only spent part-time managing, but they didn't have a big professional staff to manage the business. So that was its impetus. As for the, will it continue growing? I think the best anecdotal evidence we have is attendance at the Clock conference, which doubled for each of 3 years, for the first 3 years, but this, I believe 2019 was year four. And my understanding is attendance only eked up a little bit from 2000 in 2018 to a little over 2000 in 2019. So we may have reached peak. I think we've certainly reached peak growth. There'll be more growth, but I don't think it will be as rapid.
Thanks, Ron. One of the things you mentioned earlier was change management. And here at LAD, we just released a toolkit on how to manage change. What do you think makes it so difficult for lawyers, change management? What do you think makes it so difficult?
Well, I'll tell you a story that I heard at a conference just a few months ago. This is a large law firm, but I think the same would be true for a law department, is sometimes the lawyers are so busy with having to deliver advice that it's very hard to take the time to try something new. So this was a firm that's investing in innovation, but they're having trouble deploying a machine learning tool for contract due diligence, because anytime a deal came up, there were tight deadlines, and the lawyers on the team, although they were receptive in personality to doing it, were always worried that, well, if they do that and it doesn't work, then they're stuck. So part of it is being too busy. Another part is lawyers are creatures of precedent, and so it's harder to persuade them that what they're doing may need improvement. And then finally, the vendors of, whether it's process change or legal tech, often don't have a clear answer of what's in it for me. That's the key question for change management. And if I show you how to do something and it's way easier for you personally, you're more likely to adopt it. And I think a lot of the changes people have pushed don't really make the work that much easier. So it has to be, you know, some people say it has to be a 10 times improvement to get people's attention across the board. I don't know if it's that high, but that's the way we need to think. As people, as lawyers and other professionals who work with lawyers think about legal tech and innovation, they have to avoid what I call the shiny bauble or magic wand syndrome, where buying a piece of tech will solve a problem. You have to have changes in process, changes in incentives, and a whole systems approach to making change. It's not enough just to simply buy technology. And a lot of people in the market are moving too quickly to say, I'll buy this and that will solve my problem. And just evidence tells you that won't work. And process beats technology. So there are times where you read about people doing new technology and you say, well, given their problem and given some process improvement, they probably could have used old tech or existing tech to fix it. So I think people have to rethink how they operate.
And finally, Ron, what advice do you have some of our listeners who are lawyers or in-house legal professionals who are thinking of buying a new piece of legal technology to solve some of their problems?
I would say, first, have you really carefully analyzed the problem and understand all of its dimensions and confirmed with end users or clients or customers that it's a problem for them? Second, have you evaluated whether your existing technology may be able to solve it? So in the white paper, I said, your existing technology, I'll just pick a number out of the air, but if it gets you 80% of the way, is that good enough? And so you might be able to use existing technology. And third, have you put together a good plan for the change management, including metrics for what will define success both in adoption and in improvements in the work, either in efficiency or outcomes?
Great. Thanks, Ron. And did you have another example of where you've seen legal innovation really show a return on investment?
Yeah. So there's, at least in the United States, there's been a rapid explosion of legal analytic products from vendors taking publicly available primary legal data, cases and statutes, typically cases, and extracting more information from them than the traditional legal publishers had. And we've seen an explosion. And the best example of that are brief analyzers, a category that was pioneered about 3 years ago by a company called Casetext. And now it has both startup competitors and last month, Bloomberg and West both announced their competing products. Now, how do we know it's been a success? The fact that you have so many players competing with that product category and so many law firms licensing it and anecdotes of how it's achieving better outcomes, I think is as good a sign as any that it's successful.
Yeah, and actually, my former employer, Ron, was LexisNexis. And in 2015 or 16, they acquired Lex Machina, which does predictive analytics for US law. So it's definitely a space which is heating up. And maybe just quickly, we can talk about consolidation in the legal tech sector, because the past few weeks have seen a number of acquisitions by those larger players like Thomson Reuters, like West, like Bloomberg, like LexisNexis. Do you think that consolidation will continue?
Yes, only on the general principle that there are so many startups in legal tech, whether it's AI or deal platforms. And it's not, industries don't operate that way. They don't have hundreds of point solutions at any one time. So it's not that point solutions can't continue to exist and grow and be nice businesses, but it's just there's so much fragmentation and duplication within and across product categories that just based on general economic and operational principles, I think it's likely we'll see consolidation, whether it's from the large publishers like LexisNexis or Thomson Reuters or Bloomberg, or through other players, private equity or a company like Roper that acquired Aderant, there are potentially many candidates that could help with that consolidation.
And that was Ron Freeman. A big thank you again to Ron for joining us on the Lodcast show. Now, as discussed throughout the episode, I will throw a bunch of resources in the show notes so you can access those toolkits and reports. A big thank you to everyone who's been listening so far, and please like and subscribe if you're enjoying this content. Hey, thanks a lot. Bye.